Greetings and welcome to the Science Podcast for January 26, 2007. I'm Stuart Wills, the online editor of Science Magazine. Today, we'll find out how a small amount of brain damage can help you quit smoking, the devious ways the bacterium responsible for plague worms its way into its hosts, and how the grasses growing in the hot spots of Yellowstone Park team up with symbiotic organisms to tolerate the heat. All this, plus the usual roundup of other stories from Science and its online daily news site, Science Now. So stick around. First up today, can a little brain damage help you quit smoking? An intriguing new finding reported in the January 26th issue of Science suggests that the answer might be yes. In the study, Antoine Bechara of the University of Southern California and the University of Iowa, along with three colleagues, found that patients recovering from lesions in a particular area of the brain were able, with surprising ease, to shake previous smoking habits and to stay off cigarettes for good. Dr. Bechara is on the line from Iowa to tell us more. Dr. Bechara, welcome to the Science Podcast.
Thank you.
As I understand it, Dr. Bechara, this research deals with a particular region of the brain called the insula. What in particular got your team first interested in the tie that this region might have with smoking addiction?
We had a wonderful patient registry at the University of Iowa, and over the years, I observed these cases where actually people report that they just quit smoking, just like that. But one particular case kind of sparked the whole project. Nathan, and that's not the true name at all, was a right-handed male who lost interest in smoking after suffering from an ischemic stroke at the age of 28. Now, he was 38 years old when we interviewed him again. So Nathan started smoking at the age of 14. At the time of his stroke, he was smoking more than 40 unfiltered cigarettes per day. Now, he was aware of the negative health consequences of smoking before his stroke, though he was not particularly concerned about these consequences. He had never tried to quit, and he had no intention of quitting at the time of his stroke. Now, Nathan smoked his last cigarette on the evening before his stroke. When asked about his reason for quitting smoking, he stated, "I forgot that I was a smoker." So we asked him to elaborate, but he said that he did not forget the fact that he was a smoker, but rather that his body forgot the urge to smoke. So he reported that he felt no urge to smoke during his hospital stay. His roommate in the hospital was a smoker who would frequently go outside to smoke, but Nathan said that he was so disgusted by the smell when his roommate returned from smoking that he asked to change the room. So Nathan stated that while he came to believe that his stroke was caused in some way by smoking, this was not the reason why he quit. He stated that he never actually tried to quit smoking, but rather that it seemed that spontaneously he had completely lost interest in smoking.
Okay, so you had this very interesting case study, and you had the notion that you wanted to investigate further what was driving this phenomenon. How did you actually go about doing that?
We were very interested in differentiating between two kinds of quitting. We all know when somebody gets a heart attack or get a stroke, the person would try very hard to quit because they are afraid of the health consequences. So we wanted to distinguish between what we call a disruption of smoking addiction, that is, quitting without any effort whatsoever, like the case of Nathan, versus patients who manage to quit, but they had to try really hard and it wasn't easy to quit. So then quitting, it was somebody who quit in the month before being interviewed, but the disruption of smoking addiction was strictly defined according to four criteria that we used. One is that the patient reported that they quit smoking less than one day after the lesion onset. They rated the difficulty of quitting as less than 3 on a scale of 1 to 7, and they reported that they quit in one attempt, and they reported that they felt no urges to smoke since quitting.
So these were people who were sort of able to, you know, if you will, just turn it off like a light switch after they recovered.
Right, and they never smoked again. So we picked 307 patients at random, smokers and non-smokers, and smokers who even quit before their lesion onset. And by looking, we identified 19 patients with lesions that included the insula. 6 of them had right insula damage, and 13 had a left insula damage. And Nathan also had a left insula damage, by the way. And we found 50 patients with lesions that did not include the insula. So all these patients had been smoking more than 5 cigarettes per day for at least 2 years at the time of their lesion onset. So the average was 27 cigarettes per day, and they had been smoking for a total of 28 years at the time of their lesion onset.
Okay, so you ended up with this group of 69 patients who both had a history of smoking and were being treated for some kind of brain lesion. What did you find when you looked at that group?
Out of the 69 the patients that we identified, 37 of them did not quit smoking, but 32 of them were quitters. And we ended up actually with 16 quitters who did not meet the criteria of disruption of smoking addiction, and 16 patients who had a disruption of smoking addiction. Basically, we came to the conclusion that the odds of quitting with a disruption of smoking addiction were more than 130 times greater after a lesion that affected either the right or the left insula than after a lesion that did not affect the insula. Now, it's important to note that nothing in the brain is 100%, happens 100% of the time. We did find, for example, 4 cases who had disruption of smoking addiction that did not involve the insula. But we looked to see if there's anything common about them, anything anatomically common about them, but there was none. So we cannot explain why that happened.
But although nothing is 100%, it is pretty striking that the people with damage to the who were recovering from damage to the insula were so much more likely to have this disruption of smoking dependence. So what do you think accounts for this effect?
We can speculate. That is, we know that the insula is important for emotions and feelings, and the functional neuroimaging studies tell us that it's probably the urges and the desires and the craving to smoke that would be the critical process, and probably we are interfering with this urge to smoke. But again, this is speculative on our part. What is factual is that we have identified a knockout region in the brain that behaviorally stops the entire addiction.
Okay, but we do have this insight regarding some sort of connection between this area of the brain and addiction or lack thereof to smoking, the ability to quit. What's the therapeutic value of that insight, do you think? I mean, presumably we can't just suggest that people who want to quit smoking go out and get an insular lesion.
Well, I think, you know, the findings have a lot of therapeutic implications, and the implications are not only for smoking addiction. I think they will apply also to drug addiction, but also, in my opinion, I think they will also apply to obesity. The point is that now we have a target in the brain that we can go after to knock out. There are a lot of receptors in that area. There are a lot of pharmacology and neurobiology that we don't really know about that area. And unfortunately, this area has been overlooked, you know, in drug addiction research or even in nicotine addiction. So it's quite possible now to open new directions for pharmacological studies aimed at specific receptors within the insula that can be targeted to stop smoking.
Well, Dr. Bishara, thanks very much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
The paper by Antoine Bishara and three colleagues on how damage to the brain's insula region can disrupt smoking behavior appears in the January 26th issue of Science. Coming up in a moment, the ins and outs of the devious plague bacterium.
Did you know that the journal Science was founded by Thomas Edison in 1880? Even Edison's inventive mind could not have imagined its evolution into the world's leading journal of groundbreaking research and scientific news, in print and online. AAAS members can access seminars, podcasts, and all issues since 1880. Read today's stories and preview tomorrow's research, all at www.sciencemag.org. AAAS, advancing science into the future.
Although the word plague inevitably has historical connotations, the suite of diseases caused by the plague bacterium Yersinia pestis remains a concern even today. A study in this week's Science by Wyndham Latham, William Goldman, and two other colleagues from the Washington University of St. Louis breaks important new ground on the mechanisms behind one of the disease's most virulent forms. Dr. Goldman is with us now to tell us a bit more about the work. Dr. Goldman, welcome.
Thanks, Stuart.
Well, Dr. Goldman, as I suggested in my brief introduction, I guess most of us naturally associate the plague with the Middle Ages. Why is it important to study plague now?
Well, bubonic plague is still with us. It's maintained in a cycle of infection between rodents and their fleas. And there are periodic epidemics, like the 1994 epidemic in India, that remind us of its potential public health risk. But the bigger concern for human health now is primary pneumonic plague, which is a more rapid and deadlier disease than bubonic plague, and is transmitted person to person by airborne exposure. So this syndrome is caused by the exact same bacterium, Yersinia pestis, that's responsible for bubonic plague, and we still see epidemics of pneumonic plague from time to time, such as the one that started just last year, or I guess in 2005, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And because this disease is so rapid in progression and has a very high mortality, the modern concern, particularly in the last 5 years or so, is its potential use as a bioterrorist weapon. And for this reason, in fact, the U.S. government has placed Yersinia pestis in the same danger category as anthrax and Ebola virus and smallpox. And we even have to do our research in a carefully monitored containment facility.
Okay, well, so this Yersinia pestis causes all of these types of the disease, and as you point out, it has relevance today. Tell us a little bit more about this actual organism.
Yersinia pestis is really a very versatile organism. It's able to infect different kinds of animals, fleas, rodents, humans, and it's able to infect us through different routes and ends up causing these different diseases that you just mentioned. So the organism has to be very skilled at adapting to constantly changing environments. It has to deal with different temperatures in fleas versus mammals. It proliferates in different mammalian organ systems like the lymphatics or the lungs or the bloodstream. And it's able to survive the natural host responses to infection, like inflammation. And it accomplishes these things by activating certain genes at certain times. And we're especially interested in understanding how bacterial gene expression helps control the progress of infection and also helps the organisms respond to all of these changes. It's a special challenge to understand these things for Yersinia pestis because the infection doesn't stay in one place. Bubonic plague starts with a local bite. The organism spreads to the lymph nodes, and if it's not treated, it enters the bloodstream, and that causes an infection we call septicemia, which is typically fatal. Pneumonic plague, on the other hand, starts in the lungs. It can later enter the bloodstream to cause septicemia, but pneumonic plague typically kills so quickly that patients die of the lung infection itself rather than septicemia.
And I guess, given its relevance today, you were looking in particular at the pneumonic form, the form that attacks in the lungs, as you say, and how it gets its foothold there?
That's right. Since my lab specializes in studying respiratory infections, both bacterial and fungal. Pneumonic plague is a new project for us, and the first thing that we did was to develop and characterize a mouse model of respiratory infection by Yersinia pestis. And we saw that this model accurately mimics the human syndrome from symptoms to pathology, even to the rapid death. And interestingly, we learned that pneumonic plague is a two-stage disease. The first stage is a period during which the bacteria are multiplying rapidly in the lungs, but the host doesn't seem to recognize that anything is wrong. There's almost no inflammatory response and no symptoms. And then, about 36 hours later, the disease progresses into a second phase, which features a great deal of inflammation, obvious symptoms of a severe respiratory infection. And we also see that the bacteria have entered the bloodstream. But ultimately, what kills the animals is the overwhelming pneumonia. And even in the animal model, you can see why this disease is such a clinical challenge, because by the time patients develop symptoms that seem severe enough that they would consult a physician, the disease has progressed so far that it's difficult to treat.
So it's too late at that point.
Yes.
So what did your work on this that you're publishing in Science reveal about how this disease works?
Well, this work was focused on a single gene that appears to be pivotal in how the course of the disease develops. And the gene, which is called PLA, it's just spelled P-L-A, encodes a protein that's called plasminogen activator. So to explain how PLA works, even briefly, you just have to know that infections often stimulate a natural host response by our coagulation system. That's the system that deposits fibrin to form blood clots. And these fibrin deposits act as barriers that help contain an infection and slow its spread. So PLA is thought to promote the systems that dissolve fibrin clots, and presumably that allows the bacteria to spread more easily, since they can now escape entrapment within those fibrin walls. So what we wanted to do was evaluate the role of PLA in the process of pneumonic plague, and we generated a mutant strain of Yersinia pestis, which is missing just the PLA gene. So now remember I said that pneumonic plague is a two-phase disease. The second phase features a great deal of inflammation. The mutant that's lacking PLA is able to start the infection normally, but the disease never progresses into the second stage. The bacteria don't show the same rise in number in the lungs. We see little evidence of inflammation. We even see activation of lung repair. But the bacteria do enter the bloodstream, and we see spread to other tissues like the spleen. And ultimately, the mice infected with that mutant strain do die, but they're not dying of a pulmonary infection. They're probably dying of septicemia, and that process takes much longer.
So taking the PLA out doesn't completely stop the disease, but it slows it down and kind of puts it in different bodily centers.
That's really right. And so really we concluded from this that the PLA gene is essential for the normal progression of pneumonic plague, and without that, the disease essentially stalls in the early phase before the development of inflammation and pneumonia.
So what does this mean for actually fighting pneumonic plague?
Well, when it comes to treating pneumonic plague, timing is everything. It's a very aggressive pulmonary disease, but the appearance of symptoms is delayed, so diagnosis is typically too late to give antibiotics a chance to work before airway function is gone. So you can imagine that if we were able to treat patients not only with an antibiotic, but also with an inhibitor of PLA, we could potentially expand the window for effective therapy. So if you could inactivate PLA, the progression of pulmonary damage and inflammation might stop, and the antibiotics would have a longer period of time to act. In our paper, we actually did experiments where we used a genetic trick to essentially turn off PLA during the course of the disease. And the results of that experiment showed that inhibition of PLA could slow down the progress of pneumonic plague. And I think that opens the door to development of potential therapeutics based on inhibiting the action of PLA.
Well, Dr. Goldman, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
The study on the molecular mechanisms of pneumonic plague appears in the January 26th issue of Science. Just around the corner, how to cope with extreme temperatures, plant version. Stay with us.
Did you know that AAAS members help plug the power of science into public policy? Since 1973, we've brought nearly 2,000 scientists and engineers to Washington, D.C. as science and technology policy fellows. They provide scientific analysis to policymakers in congressional offices and in federal agencies. Find out more at fellowships.AAAS.org. AAAS, advancing science careers, enhancing public policy.
In the volcanically active Yellowstone National Park, soil temperatures can reach as high as 50 degrees Celsius, or more than 120 degrees Fahrenheit. Yet grasses plunging roots down into this superheated soil somehow manage to thrive. A paper published more than 4 years ago in Science revealed the secret to these grasses' success, a fascinating symbiotic relationship with a heat-tolerant fungus. Now, a study by Luis Marquez and colleagues has revealed that this ultra-hothouse symbiosis actually depends on yet a third partner, a hitherto uncharacterized virus infecting the fungus itself. On the line to talk with us about the work is Marilyn Rusink, one of the study's authors. Dr. Rusink, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much. It's great to talk to you.
Well, Dr. Rusink, this seems like a story that's getting more and more complicated. Maybe we should start with just the grass and the fungus.
All right. Well, my colleagues from Washington and Montana have been studying fungal endophytes from plants that live in extreme environments for quite a while. So most wild plants have fungal endophytes that are associated with them. But in an extreme environment, like in Yellowstone National Park, or they've looked in tidal zones where salt levels are high, or in drought conditions, it seems like in those environments, the endophytes are critical for the plant's survival. So in this system, they tested the plant's ability to tolerate high soil temperatures with and without the endophytes. And this was done both in the lab and in the field. And they found that the endophyte was required for thermal tolerance.
Okay, so there was a clear relationship between the grass's ability to tolerate these hot temperatures and the presence of this fungus. What made your team think there might be a bit more going on here?
Well, my lab has been studying RNA virus evolution and population biology for quite a while, about 15 years. But we've only studied acute viruses, which are viruses that start an infection, you get a rapid rise in virus titer, and you usually get disease, and then the infection is resolved either by death of the host or the immune response from the host. And we were very interested in looking at populations of persistent viruses. These are viruses that infect their host for a long time, maybe generations, and they don't necessarily cause any disease. And they've been very understudied. I guess people are not interested in these less dramatic viruses that don't cause disease. But fungi very often have double-stranded RNA viruses that persist, and they're usually vertically transmitted and have very rarely been associated with any phenotype. So we started this to look at the populations of these seemingly benign and persistent viruses. When we looked at the endophytic fungi that they had collected in Yellowstone, we noticed that there were these double-stranded RNAs that's indicative of viral infection. They were always found in the fungi from the geothermal areas, but they were quite variable in other isolates of the same fungus. So we thought it was worth pursuing this further.
And you found, if I understand it correctly, a virus in this particular fungus that allows the fungus to confer heat tolerance on the plant. How did you actually tease all that out?
Well, we started with just the usual things. We made cDNA clones of the virus. We determined the sequence. We found it wasn't really related to any known viruses. It had an identifiable replicase, but the other proteins didn't give us any significant hints in GenBank. So we purified the virus from the cultured fungi. We looked at it in the electron microscope. And we also showed that the double-stranded RNA was what was found in the virion. So that means that the genome is double-stranded RNA. So then we wanted to see what it was doing, and we needed a virus-free isolate. And that actually proved quite difficult.
Finding a fungus that didn't have this virus,
right,
the same
getting
species.
A virus-free isolate, right. So we have been able to cure other fungi of their viruses by a variety of methods, but these didn't work for this fungus. So, in fact, when we found the virus-free isolate, it was somewhat serendipitous. We had some frozen mycelia that we had prepared for double-stranded RNA extractions, and then we decided we wanted to grow some more of this particular culture, so we inoculated plates with it, and it grew quite well, and we found the virus was gone. So, in fact, it was a freeze-thaw cycle. that it was what cured the fungus of the virus. So now we had the virus-free isolate, and we wanted to reintroduce the virus back to that virus-free isolate to really prove that it had some effect. So that was done with a process called anastomosis. So you grow the virus-free and the virus-containing fungus on the same plate, and where they meet, there is some cytoplasmic exchange that goes on, and that allowed us to reintroduce the virus to the fungus. We did have to repeat this 36 times before we got a strain that had the virus reintroduced, however, so it was quite time-consuming. So then we colonized the plants with the virus-free fungus, the wild-type fungus, and then the fungus that we had reintroduced the virus into. And what we found was that the plants that were colonized by virus-free fungus behaved just like plants that were endophyte-free. They had no thermal tolerance.
Whereas both sets of the plants with the fungus still retained that thermal tolerance.
With the virus.
Yeah, or yes. With the virus, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So is there any idea how this actually works on a molecular level?
Well, we don't know yet. We're working hard to find out what the mechanism is for this thermal tolerance. And one of the things we're doing is expressing each viral gene individually in the fungus and then testing those fungi. We are also looking at other obvious things like reactive oxygen species and components like trehalose that we know are involved in things like drought tolerance. But really, right now, we don't know. We're just working pretty hard on that.
Well, finally, Dr. Rusink, how would you characterize the importance of this work? What does this tell us about how these kinds of symbiotic relationships develop and operate?
Well, I hope that that this will make people look at viruses in a little different way. Our understanding of viruses is very biased. We think of them mainly as agents of disease, and that's because that's what's been studied. But I think if this may help people think about viruses as not necessarily agents of disease, but having other roles in the biology of their hosts. And I also think it will help people to think about viruses as symbiotic with their hosts. They fit the definition of symbiosis perfectly, that is, of two dissimilar entities that live in or on one another in an intimate relationship. In this case, the virus is a mutualistic symbiont rather than antagonistic, which is how we would describe viruses that cause disease. I think this is probably quite a common thing for viruses, but we just have to get out there and look for them.
Well, Dr. Rusink, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
The paper by Luis Marquez, Marilyn Rusink, and colleagues appears in the January 26th issue of Science. Finally today, Eric Stockstead, the managing editor of Science's free daily news site, Science Now, is in the studio with Tanisha Riley of AAAS for our usual roundup of other recent stories.
Eric, welcome back.
Nice to be here.
So what are you going to talk to us about today?
Three things, Tanisha. First, we've got a story about how intestinal parasites seem to help patients with multiple sclerosis. Then we're going to talk a little bit about a new catalyst that could be widely useful for industrial chemistry. And wrap up with a new tool for figuring out better ways to farm.
Interesting. Let's start out with the story about intestinal worms. That sounds rather appetizing.
Well, of course, intestinal parasites are no fun at all. But there's an intriguing correlation with multiple sclerosis, and that is that that so-called autoimmune disease turns out to be far more common in developed countries where parasitic infections are no longer a problem. Compare that with developing countries which have more parasitic infections but lower rates of MS. That connection intrigued researchers in Buenos Aires, so for 4 years they tracked the health of a dozen patients with MS who had parasitic infections and another dozen who didn't. What they found was that the people with the infections had far fewer bouts of worsening MS. Then by looking at blood samples, the researchers figured out that the infections had ramped up levels of three kinds of immune cells called regulatory T cells. Now the idea here is that these cells are concentrating on fighting the parasites, but in the process they somehow happen to suppress a different arm of the immune system that causes multiple sclerosis.
So does this mean we should all make sure to get our regular dose of parasites with our multivitamins?
Well, first of all, they didn't actually demonstrate the parasites prevent MS. And what they ultimately hope to do is learn what it is about the parasites that tweaks the immune system into behaving better, then develop drugs. Because really what we want is no MS and no parasites.
Okay. And next, a better way to use nitrogen? I guess this relates to the rising cost of energy these days.
Nitrogen is used to make a lot of useful things, like plastics, ammonia, and synthetic fertilizers. That's a pretty energy-intensive process because the nitrogen that's found in air occurs as molecules, each consisting of two nitrogen atoms. Those pairs are joined by strong triple bonds, so you have to crack apart the bonds to free up the atoms. 3 years ago, scientists came up with a new catalyst based on zirconium that takes atmospheric nitrogen, cracks it apart, adds hydrogen, and voila, you've got ammonia. Now, they've gone on to make the catalyst a little more versatile, and what it does here is it uses the metallic element hafnium, hooks up nitrogen with carbon dioxide. The product you get is hydrazine, which is a basic ingredient in a wide range of chemical compounds, and the process uses less energy.
Well, that sounds useful. What's the downside, though?
It's not really a catalyst in an important way. Catalysts keep churning through chemical reactions. This one doesn't, because the hafnium complex has to be recycled and regenerated, but it's a start.
And finally, Eric, something about the risk of farming?
Well, we're not talking about getting fingers caught in combines. The risk here is for wild species, and they often get the short end of the stick when it comes to agriculture. Their homes get plowed up, they get drenched with pesticides, and on and on. It all adds up to fewer species of butterflies, birds, and insects, a loss in biodiversity. Now, concern about this goes a long way back, and researchers and governments have been trying to come up with alternative practices for farmers that ought to help, such as payments for maintaining hedgerows in British farms. But nobody knows if it really works. So last week, three researchers in England published a paper in Science describing a pretty simple scheme for evaluating farming practices. Really what it does is it adds up individual risks to a species. Those are risks like loss of food or nesting habitat. Then they tried it out with 62 species of British birds, and they found that this approach did a pretty good job of predicting the conservation status of these birds, whether they're at high risk of population decline, for example. And it's not just limited to birds. They really could apply it broadly to any species and pretty much any risk they might face.
Eric, thanks a lot.
Pleasure to be here.
Eric Stockstedt is the managing editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of science. You can catch up with these and other stories on the site at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.
And that wraps up the January 26, 2007 Science Podcast. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society, with additional financial support from the Golden Fund. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music for the show. I'm Stuart Wills, the online editor of Science. On behalf of the journal and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.